It doesn't even presume he has fewer faults than fine qualities. He might be a broken man with years of waste and wrongdoing in his wake. But one thing you can be sure of. If you aim to influence him to change, repeatedly pointing out his rap sheet will do you little good. If instead you begin to remind him of what he could be, not with hypothetical hype, but with his own history of goodness, of success, of insight, even if only a brief history, something inside him would have cause to awaken. He could begin to see what he can still be, despite what he has been. When we treat man as he is, we make him worse than he is. When we treat him as if he already were what he potentially could be, we make him what he should be. Few in history have understood the power of affirming the good in others better than the 16th President of the United States. With this one idea, Abraham Lincoln kept the nation together. When he took the oath of office in March 1861, it was far from certain that there would ever be another inaugural address for a U.S. president. The same day he was sworn in, the Stars and Bars, the Confederacy's new flag, was first raised over Montgomery, Alabama. In the months since Lincoln had been elected, 7 states seceded from the Union. Everyone, friend and foe alike, wanted to know what this man had to say about the breakaway states. History now views this as one of the greatest speeches ever given, precisely because Lincoln wrote with a spirit of reconciliation. He wasn't weak. He warned about the consequences of any attack on the Union. But he had the vision to affirm what was good at a moment when almost no one else could. Lincoln said, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies." What audacity this took! 7 states had already broken away and declared independence. War loomed. Friends? How could they possibly be seen as friends? Consider the last time a coworker betrayed you, a client lied to you, or a vendor failed to deliver on a promise. Was your first reaction to remember what he had done that was still good and true? Being disappointed, let down, or betrayed are among our most frustrating, maddening moments. Yet they also afford us rare moments to make a supreme impression. Do you recall a time someone surprised you with undeserved grace or unconditional forgiveness? The occurrence might have taken place many years ago, even during your childhood. Yet the person is likely a permanent part of your memory, with the emotion you felt still tangible. Ultimately, gaining influence is about setting yourself apart, stepping to a higher plane in the mind and heart of another. If all you do is act and react like anyone would, you will never be set apart. The reasons are simple. Competition for attention is constant. Communications are often a blur. It is challenging enough to become influential in today's express lane rat race. You need moments to show yourself altruistic and trustworthy. And seconds are all you are typically afforded. Were we all perfect individuals without a shortcoming in our lives, gaining influence through differentiation would fall solely on your ability to display a greater measure of trustworthiness than the others in a person's sphere of influence. That's a hard line to follow if your competition were all mistake-free individuals like yourself. In this scenario, competing for influence would look more like a beauty pageant, and some still treat it as such. That's not the case. We are all imperfect beings full of shortcomings, and this affords us perhaps as many opportunities to affirm others after disagreement or disappointment as in the midst of affability. The key is to allow yourself no claim on circumstantial exemptions. Use a spirit of affirmation to convey your thoughts about others whenever you can. Lest you make the mistake some do, a spirit of affirmation despite another's faults is not a show of weakness or passivity. It is not a denial of justice either, for mercy without justice is meaningless. Lincoln saw beyond the obvious and saw what might happen, and he pursued it. He wrote, "Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union. Sometimes affirming the good in others will mean reminding ourselves of that very good that exists in another. Yes, Lincoln said, things are strained, but the bonds of amity are stronger still. There was an American history the South and the North both shared. They declared independence together, built a nation together, endured war together, and all needed to be reminded of it. Lincoln concluded, "When again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Those final words are the summation of all that needed to be affirmed. There was something bigger than discord hidden deep within, a better and truer reality that needed permission to breathe. From a British monarch to a divided young nation, an appeal to the good in others turned a tense situation into a compelling challenge to change. This is not, as some might be tempted to think, an action that ignores the problems between you and another. Rather, it addresses them head-on, but in a respectful, dignifying manner that is far more successful at propelling another toward repentance, reconciliation, or improvement. In You Can't Lead with Your Feet on the Desk, Ed Fuller, President and Managing Director at Marriott International, asserts, "No worthwhile business relationship, whether with your own people or customers and partners, can endure without mutual respect. And as I've learned firsthand, showing adversaries that you regard them with admiration can resolve even violent conflicts." Fuller then tells the story of a brawl that broke out between a Marriott attorney and a hotel owner in South America when the renegotiation of a management agreement escalated into a shouting match, and the two grown men began wrestling in a hotel conference room. The struggle continued without the intervention of bystanders until the hotel owner's revolver hopped out of its holster and bumped across the floor. The wrestlers were immediately pried apart with damaged egos and no resolution. A few months passed without progress on the matter until a corporate lawyer and two company executives suggested the Marriott president pay the hotel owner a visit. Fuller describes the events that followed. "I flew to his hometown and spent 2 days traveling with him, visiting his businesses, dining at his club, and mingling with his friends. As we got to know each other apart from our business dealings, our mutual respect grew. Seeing him in a different light allowed me to understand the strength of his commitment to his employees, family, and community. The differences at the heart of the conflict weren't resolved, but I realized that he deserved my respect for who he was and what he had accomplished. A week after I left, we reached an agreement with the owner." Affirming what's good, as with every principle in this book, is not just for grandly titled people at massive moments in human history. It is for this time and this age, where the spirit of communication is often less than dignifying. From the political podium, to the digital medium, to the boardroom table, the one who speaks in a spirit of respectful, unhyperbolic affirmation will always win more friends and influence more people to positive progress than the one who communicates in criticism, condemnation, and condescension. The beauty of this principle today is that our affirmation of others is not limited to tangible interface. "While nothing can replace the effectiveness of your face-to-face interactions," explained Tom's Shoes founder Blake Mycoskie in a recent interview, "it's important to remember that the digital world can enhance relationship building." At any moment of our day, we can spread messages that affirm our friends, fans, and followers in numerous ways over email, Twitter, text, and blogs. Don't, however, make the mistake of separating the scalability of a message from the individual significance of the message. They are inextricably linked. As big as a business gets, as large a following as one accumulates, messages are still given and received on an individual level. What builds a bridge of influence between a king and his speech therapist is the same principle that builds a bridge of influence between a company and its customers, or an executive and her reports, or a father and his child. We are all united by one single desire, to be valued by another. Whether this message is conveyed is not a group decision. Each individual to whom a message was directed, whether the individual sits alone across a table or in a crowd of 3,000, determines it. In Carnegie's original book, he offered a story that has, perhaps more than any other story in its pages, struck a chord with millions of readers the world over. It was not his story. It belonged to a man named W. Livingston Larned, who called it Father Forgets. Carnegie included it as an encouragement to all of us who can so easily forget ourselves and spend days critiquing and criticizing others. It is included here with a different perspective, not of the father who finally sees his mistakes, but of the young son who, with an unconditional spirit of affirmation, wields a level of influence that changes his father forever. Listen, son, I am saying this as you lie asleep, one little paw crumpled under your cheek and the blonde curls stickily wet on your damp forehead. I have stolen into your room alone. Just a few minutes ago, as I sat reading my paper in the library, a stifling wave of remorse swept over me. Guiltily, I came to your bedside. These are the things I was thinking, son. I had been cross to you. I scolded you as you were dressing for school because you gave your face merely a dab with a towel. I took you to task for not cleaning your shoes. I called out angrily when you threw some of your things on the floor. At breakfast, I found fault, too. You spilled things. You gulped down your food. You put your elbows on the table. You spread butter too thick on your bread. And as you started off to play and I made for my train, you turned and waved a hand and called, "Goodbye, Daddy." And I frowned and said in reply, "Hold your shoulders back." Then it began all over again in the late afternoon. As I came up the road, I spied you down on your knees playing marbles. There were holes in your stockings. I humiliated you before your boyfriends by marching you ahead of me to the house. Stockings were expensive, and if you had to buy them, you would be more careful. Imagine that, son, from a father. Do you remember later, when I was reading in the library, how you came in timidly, with a sort of hurt look in your eyes? When I glanced up over my paper, impatient at the interruption, you hesitated at the door. "What is it you want?" I snapped. You said nothing, but ran across in one tempestuous plunge and threw your arms around my neck and kissed me, and your small arms tightened with an affection that God had set blooming in your heart and which even neglect could not wither. And then you were gone, pattering up the stairs. Well, son, it was shortly afterwards that my paper slipped from my hands and a terrible, sickening fear came over me. What has habit been doing to me? The habit of finding fault, of reprimanding. This was my reward to you for being a boy. It was not that I did not love you. It was that I expected too much of youth. I was measuring you by the yardstick of my own years. And there was so much that was good and fine and true in your character. The little heart of you was as big as the dawn itself over the wide hills. This was shown by your spontaneous impulse to rush in and kiss me goodnight. Nothing else matters tonight, son. I have come to your bedside in the darkness, and I have knelt there ashamed. It is a feeble atonement. I know you would not understand these things if I told them to you during your waking hours. But tomorrow, I will be a real daddy. I will chum with you, and suffer when you suffer, and laugh when you laugh. I will bite my tongue when impatient words come. I will keep saying, as if it were a ritual, "He is nothing but a boy, a little boy." I am afraid I have visualized you as a man. Yet as I see you now, son, crumpled and weary in your cot, I see that you are still a baby. Yesterday you were in your mother's arms, your head on her shoulder. I have asked too much, too much. Isn't it profound, the influence one is afforded, even the smallest among us, when affirmation comes clean off our tongue and clear from our hearts? All great progress and problem-solving with others begins when at least one party is willing to place what is already good on the table. From there, it is much easier to know where to begin and how to lead the interaction to a mutually beneficial end. Chapter 3. Connect with Core Desires. In early 2002, Time put an odd-looking computer on its cover. It had a small domed base and a jointed, shiny chrome neck affixed to a flat-screen monitor that enabled it to be pushed, pulled, turned, lowered, or raised with the nudge of a finger. It was called the iMac, and the company introducing it, Apple Computer, desperately needed it to work in order to stay in business. Apple had always been the darling of a particular computing niche, generally creative, anti-establishment types. But in the article that accompanied the cover story, its CEO, Steve Jobs, enunciated a brand new vision for consumers. He said he believed the future lay in the PC as the digital hub of camcorders, digital cameras, MP3 players, Palm PDAs, cell phones, and DVD players. He risked the company's future on a vision of a place where an entire digital life could be consolidated. And so, with the iMac, came a free suite of software that today is synonymous with the digital age: iTunes, iPhoto, and iMovie. Critics and competitors mocked Jobs. Some of Apple's longtime rivals called the computer clownish and silly, and the vision far too grand. The public? They embraced the vision and the life that it promised, and Apple Computer, now simply Apple, has seen its share price increase 4,856%. The closest competitor has increased approximately 14%. Why? Is it because other computer companies would prefer no one buy their products? Of course not. They all want to be successful. They all want to be well-liked. What they are after is more and more influence in the form of people consuming their products. The difference is that Steve Jobs recognized something Dale Carnegie championed repeatedly. To influence others to act, you must first connect to a core desire within them. This is a universal truth, whether you are dealing with children or clients or calves. One day, the famous philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson and his son were trying to get a calf into the barn. It was going rather poorly. They pushed, and the calf pulled. They pulled, and the calf pushed. Meanwhile, their housemaid noticed their predicament, and though she couldn't write brilliant essays or books, she possessed an insight she thought might solve the problem. She walked over to the calf and put her finger in its mouth. While the calf suckled, she gently led it into the barn. What did the maid know that the luminous philosopher had forgotten? She knew that one of the calf's core desires was food. Once she tapped into that desire, the calf willingly followed. Emerson and his son merely thought about what they desired, the calf in the barn so they could eat their lunch. But the calf, happily grazing in a green pasture, had little interest in descending into a dark, confined barn that curtailed his dining options. That is, until the housemaid showed up, offered her finger, and reminded the calf that some warm milk was in his future. It is an excellent metaphor because it reminds us of two key insights we often overlook when trying to influence others. 1. Influence requires more intuition than intellect. The critical contrast between the luminary Emerson and his humble housemaid is not one of dissimilar brain power. While Emerson was likely the more learned of the two, the divergence between them was one of intuition. The housemaid had what Emerson lacked. The public world tends to freely ascribe sway to those in lofty positions that require much education and aptitude: the CEO, department chair, physician, and billionaire. We assume such people can move majorities with a whisper and the snap of a finger. But as Guy Kawasaki, former chief evangelist at Apple, pointed out, If such a person does not have a deep relationship with people, she won't have much influence with them. The truth is that such stately individuals possess merely above-average conditions to influence, while the way in which influence is won remains no different for them than for anyone else. Influence is no respecter of education or experience. It goes only with the one who will set aside his status, be it high and mighty or low and lowly, and put himself in the place of another. To do so takes a shrewd and spontaneous ability to read beneath the surface of an interaction. What is essential, wrote Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, is invisible to the eye. This is an important truth to keep in mind when dealing with those you would like to win over. Influencing others is not a matter of outsmarting them. It is a matter of discerning what they truly want and offering it to them in a mutually beneficial package. He knows so little and accomplishes so much, Robert McFarlane, the third of President Reagan's six national security advisors, once marveled of his boss. When Reagan left Washington more popular than when he first took office, writes Richard Norton Smith, he accomplished something that hadn't been done since Dwight Eisenhower. How? According to President Obama, Reagan recognized the American people's hunger for accountability and change. He tapped into what people were already feeling. 2. Influence requires a gentle hand. There were Emerson and his son in a four-handed, eight-legged tug-of-war with the obstinate calf who was holding his ground. It is no way to sway another to your side. Onto the scene, in great contrast, strides the housemaid with an index finger extended, straight and not hooked, no less. And the once stubborn calf is suddenly light on its hooves and willingly wrapped around the housemaid's pointer. Lest we forget, it is a memorable image of what little moving we have to do to move another to action. As a constant reminder, former U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower displayed a paperweight in the Oval Office that in Latin read, "Gently in manner, strong in deed." There is no question of his global influence. Action springs from what we fundamentally desire, author Harry Overstreet writes in Influencing Human Behavior, and the best piece of advice which can be given to would-be persuaders, whether in business, in the home, in the school, in politics, is, first, arouse in the other person an eager want. He who can do this has the whole world with him. He who cannot walks a lonely way. The practice of connecting with core desires is applicable across industry lines and international borders. It is as important for the energy executive from Holland as it is the executive producer in Hollywood. The interpersonal efforts that inevitably succeed are those in which the messenger stops dictating and starts discovering what the recipient wants. The interpersonal efforts that inevitably fail, be they corporate collaboration, personal cooperation, or artistic rendering, are those in which the messenger attempts to tell the recipient what he wants. This is perhaps no more evident than in the sales industry, an industry of which, in a semantic sense, we are all part. In his book, Killing the Sale, best-selling author Todd Duncan describes the 10 fatal mistakes salespeople make. One of them he calls arguing. And when we fail to connect with another's core needs, we are just as guilty of it, whether or not we call selling our profession. He said, "The mistake of arguing is staking your sales success on your ability to state your case in convincing fashion. It's mastering a monologue and then expecting the jury of your prospects to be convinced to take your side. But establishing an initial level of trust takes more than flowery monologue. It takes dialogue. It takes actual conversation. There is no other way for you to know your product or service will meet a person's needs." He later cites Dr. Theodore Zeldin, author of Conversation, who makes the point succinctly. Real conversation catches fire. It is mind-boggling that despite the millions of branding and marketing dollars spent every year, much is still spent on the messenger's wants or whimsies rather than the recipient's core desires. We get an idea in our head for who we want to be or how we want others to perceive our offering, and we spend more time shaping and shining that image than we do ascertaining whether the image really matters to those to whom it must matter. Most individuals and organizations invest more resources in campaigning than in connecting. It should be the other way around. Consider the comparison chart Duncan offers juxtaposing what the two forms of interpersonal communication say about you. Dialogue, monologue. Considerate, conceited. Authentic, fake. Transparent, manipulative. Secure, needy. Interested in meeting needs. Interested in making money. Builds trust. Builds tension. Of course, connecting to people's core desires does not mean the world will be your oyster. Suffice it to say that without this approach, others will remain largely unapproachable. Their ears will close, and their eyes will look elsewhere for something or someone more engaging. And their options are endless in the very world Steve Jobs saw in 2002. Fortunately, most corporate emails, company tweets, brand blog entries, and commercial ad campaigns are monologues meant to broadcast opinions, distinguish brands, launch products, and construct personas. It is precisely because this is so that the person who speaks in a spirit of dialogue and altruistic discovery nabs a significant advantage. How do you know if you hold this advantage? An honest inventory of your impact is usually enough. Have your employees really stepped it up, or do they remain in a cycle of fits and falters? You are confident your marriage is on the upswing, but what does your spouse have to say? You insist the customers are impressed by your new products. Does your sales revenue concur? You say your brand is sweeping the nation, but against what standard are you measuring brand recognition? In The Seven Arts of Change, author David Shaner clarifies the difference between those who truly connect with core desires and those who are merely playing influence the way kids play doctor. He writes, "Nearly every study of organizational change over the past two decades indicates that companies fail to make the change they intend approximately 70% of the time. Before organizational change can succeed, it must first occur at the subtle spiritual level in the individuals of the organization. All lasting transformation must begin there, because ultimately, your spirit and mine is the primary driver of all our behavior." True change is born of an interpersonal reach that takes hold of the deepest part of an individual. Shaner's explanation is dead on, and he should know. His company, Connect Consulting, has for 30 years helped multinational corporations such as Duracell, Ryobi, Mark USA, and SVP Worldwide lead successful company change efforts. His words remind us that no company-wide campaign or individual communication strategy garners influence until it connects with people at their core. It is an essential principle in all your efforts to influence others, whether your audience is a 5-year-old child or 5,000 employees. A former U.S. Secretary of Education once recounted how he didn't learn this essential element of engagement until after his first year on the job. He felt pretty good about his progress. He'd ventured out and given speeches, and people had applauded and smiled. He'd attended many dinner parties and sumptuous gatherings, and all seemed to go off without a hitch. But to what end? While home over Christmas with time to reflect, he came to acknowledge that while he'd been highly visible and highly promissory, nothing in the department had really changed. 5,000 employees showed up on time, they completed their assigned work, they went home. There was movement, but few, if any, were moved, inside or outside the office walls. He wanted to understand why. Over the first 2 months of the following year, he spent a lot of time with the people who really ran the Department of Education, the career civil service workers who pressed forward no matter which political party filled the White House. He came to the sobering realization that while he stood on the bridge, turning the wheel, the wheel wasn't connected to anything below. And since he had no authority to hire or fire from the civil service ranks, the only way he could influence positive progress in the department was by winning them over. The problem was, they'd seen politicians come and go. They'd grown tired and cynical. They'd given up on deriving inspiration from the top. The secretary's wife suggested the way to win them over was by reminding them he was passionate about education, and to do so not with new words but with new actions. Go to schools. Spend time with kids. Do retail. Everyone will notice because these are the things they really care about. "I don't do retail," he huffed. "I'm the Secretary of Education. I do wholesale." His wife, the daughter of a salesman, smiled. "Darling," she said, "if you can't do retail, you'll never do wholesale." She was right, and the secretary knew it. For the next year, he toured the country, rolled up his sleeves, read stories, listened to teachers, and was reminded how much he loved retail education. It was a personal victory. More significant, however, was the effect his actions had on his employees. Their passion was revived. Passion for their daily tasks, for better education, for more opportunities for more families. They were inspired by the secretary's work because his actions had accomplished something the speeches and sumptuous gatherings had not. They had tapped a core desire for the tireless Department of Education workers. Purpose. They wanted to believe again. They just needed to be reminded that their work still mattered. The secretary offered this reminder, and it dramatically turned the tide. In our rushed world, it is easy to forego the secretary's level of analysis. So much of our digital communication is one way that we come to believe we have limited opportunity to uncover another's perspective. While we communicate with more and more people every day, we also become more insular in our approach. We are far more inclined to focus on how we can best broadcast our points from our own perspective, quickly, broadly, or both. Isn't this what we witness all around us? It is easy to get so caught up in the fray that we forget what we are aiming for. Connection. Influence. Agreement. Collaboration. We can start to believe the battle is won by mere frequency and occasional originality, useful strategies in the right context, but greatly insufficient as your only influence strategies. There is a good side, however, to this constant barrage of one-sided broadcasting, which spans the spectrum from corporate posturing to celebrity positioning. Today, with a few keystrokes, we can better educate ourselves about other people's perspectives and goals. Earlier, we discussed the dangers of using your digital space to spout off your complaints. Most of us are more discerning about what we divulge. We reveal what matters to us, what we think about often, what we love and like, and hope to see happen soon. These tidbits of information add up to a body of knowledge that offers clues or even clear windows to our core desires. This knowledge is invaluable where influence is concerned because, like the calf that just wanted more food, we only move toward what moves us. Part 2. 6 Ways to Make a Lasting Impression. Chapter 1. Take Interest in Others' Interests. When it comes to learning the quickest way to win friends, shall we turn to the person with the most followers on Twitter, the blogger with the most digs, the savviest salesperson, or the most powerful politician? While each can boast of abundant followership, and while each will likely offer good advice, such people might not be our best role models. In fact, our best role models might not be people at all. Perhaps dogs are. Whether we've stepped outside for 2 minutes or traveled for 2 weeks, dogs welcome our return as if we were heroes. They never demean us or mock us or stand us up for dates. They exist to befriend us, to orbit around us as the center of their existence. Are they ever without pure joy just being in our presence? Dogs are called man's best friend for a reason. Stories of canine loyalty are the stuff of legend. The great poet Byron wrote of his dog Boson, "He had all the virtues of man and none of his vices." These are also the stories of our day. John Katz's A Dog Year and John Grogan's Marley and Me were nothing if not love stories written by men grieved by their dog's passing. Dogs know by some divine instinct that you can make more friends in minutes by becoming genuinely interested in other people than you can in months of trying to get other people interested in you. It is more than a furry, four-legged platitude. It is a primary principle without which no person can gain real, relational traction with another. The great irony of human relations, especially when viewed through the lens of a canine, is that our longing for significance in the lives of others should be so simple to meet, yet we complicate the matter. Our biggest struggle is selfishness, the single greatest deterrent to amity. That we are interested primarily in ourselves is not a phenomenon as new as Twitter or Facebook. It predates Friendster and MySpace. It came before cell phones and email and the internet. In the 1930s, when Carnegie was penning the original manuscript of this book, the New York Telephone Company made a detailed study of telephone conversations to find out which word was the most frequently used. The personal pronoun I was used 3,900 times in 500 telephone conversations. Our selfishness, or more politely, our self-interest, populates the morals of the great fables. Icarus swoops and soars into the sun's warmth, melting the wax on his wings, sending him plummeting to the ocean below because he's thinking only of himself, ignoring the pleas of his father. Peter Rabbit incurs Mr. McGregor's wrath by ignoring his mother's commands to stay out of his garden. Why did Adam and Eve disobey God in the Garden of Eden? They were thinking only of themselves. This self-interest isn't something anyone is likely to change. It is a gravity-like reality. We are born with innate fight-or-flight tendencies. That is to say, our body of words and actions trends towards self-preservation. Yet we often forget to consider whom we are really fighting against and to what destination we are fleeing. If we are not mindful, our self-defense can turn into self-detention, keeping us from meaningful interaction and, in some cases, cutting us off from interpersonal progress altogether. If we are not mindful, the destination to which we flee can become a lonely, isolated isle. Like the city of Troy, whose walls of great defense became the source of its great demise, we can insulate ourselves to the point of interpersonal futility. It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow men, wrote Alfred Adler, the famous Austrian psychotherapist, who has the greatest difficulties in life and provides the greatest injury to others. It is from such individuals that all human failures spring. That's quite an audacious statement, but it is a statement borne out in fact. Humanity's greatest failures, from the killing fields of Cambodia to the collapse of Lehman Brothers, are the result of people interested only in themselves. Damn the collateral damage. These are extreme examples, but the everyday versions are just as disturbing. The general counsel busted for taking a bribe never thought of the shareholders who were counting on that stock for their retirement. The pro athlete who took performance-enhancing drugs never considered how his actions would affect his teammates, his team's future, or the sport he claims to love. The husband and father caught in his lie was more interested in preserving a double life than protecting his family's hearts. Still, self-preservation's downfall is about more than catastrophes. Think back to the quote. It is the individual who is not interested in his fellow men who has the greatest difficulties in life. Adler is simply explaining that a self-centered life is the most problematic life one can live. A life lived in constant interpersonal struggle, few true friends, shallow, short-lived influence. This can seem a foreboding principle to embody in an age in which we are rewarded for brooding over and broadcasting our interests far and wide. But the ancient maxim is still true. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Our effectiveness with others is ultimately a matter of motive and merchandise. Why, in the end, are you communicating, and what, in the end, are you promoting? Today, people are more informed and subsequently more intuitive than ever. Most of us immediately see through a person whose messaging is only for personal benefit. We see gimmicks a mile away. We run from underhanded approaches. Instead, we gravitate to what feels real and lasting. We embrace those whose messaging offers mutual benefit. Andrew Sullivan, one of the world's top political bloggers, has considered such matters for more than a decade. Once the youngest ever editor-in-chief of the venerable New Republic, Sullivan was diagnosed HIV positive in the early 1990s, when it was still a death sentence. After leaving that post, Sullivan became one of the Internet's first big political bloggers, with his site hitting more than 300,000 unique visitors per month in 2003. One of the things that set Sullivan apart from his peers was an intentional interaction with his readership. He wanted his blog, The Daily Dish, to be about more than politics. He wanted loyal readers, and he genuinely wanted to know more about the people who followed him. He came up with the idea for View From Your Window, in which he asked his readers to submit shots of the world outside their homes. As with most things on the Internet, he had no idea if it would hit. "I wanted to see their worlds," he explained. "I was giving all of these people all of this access to mine, but one-way interactions are ultimately boring." It was no small gesture, and it soon boosted his relationships with readers. After the gregarious feature was introduced, Sullivan's work became the centerpiece for the Atlantic Monthly's online strategy, and that site's traffic increased by 30%. It is no surprise that Sullivan's robust blog following remained when he moved his blog to Newsweek and The Daily Beast. People are attracted to people who care about what interests them. The irony of this principle, take interest in others' interests, is that its effectiveness is predicated on others thinking of themselves. Its effectiveness essentially requires others being self-interested. There are two things to say about this. First, self-interest in its purest form is part of human nature. Fight or flight is fact. This principle does not deny self-interest's existence in all our lives. Instead, it indicates that most people on most days forget the other side of the human equation, everyone else. Most take self-interest to the self-centered end of the spectrum. The effectiveness of this principle is therefore tied directly to the infrequency with which most choose to think outside themselves on most days. The one who chooses, conversely, to take interest in others' interests on a daily basis is set apart. We remember such people, befriend them, and come to trust them more deeply. Influence is ultimately an outcropping of trust. The higher the trust, the greater the influence. Second, the pinnacle of this principle is not complete self-denial. Notice the principle is not replace your interests with others' interests. It is instead take interest in others' interests. And that is the secret to its application. When you incorporate others' interests into your own, not merely for the sake of clarifying your market or ascertaining your audience, you find that your interests are met in the process of helping others. Consider best-selling author Anne Rice, who has sold more than 110 million books in her lifetime. Her career began and achieved sustained success with her famed vampire books, including Interview with a Vampire, which was made into a major motion picture. While she is a uniquely gifted writer, no small part of her success has been her genuine interest in her readers. She responds to every bit of her readers' mail. This meant, at one time, employing 3 people full-time to meet the demand. Her interest in others has never been feigned for the sake of book sales. "It seemed to me," she explains, "that people were kind and generous enough to have an interest in me. How could I not respond? I wanted people to know that I appreciated their letters and I appreciated them. Rice has recently taken to Facebook and Twitter, giving her more direct contact with her fans. "Oh, it is so wonderful," she said. "We're having a conversation about oh so many things." She calls the community People of the Page and wrote recently, "I think we must remember that Facebook and the Internet are what we make of them. This page has accomplished something extraordinary and perhaps unique. It is truly a community, infinitely more powerful than the sum of its parts, and I thank you for making it what it is, for participating here in so many vital and inspiring discussions. This result is as important for the owner of a business as it is for authors and bloggers." In his cult favorite treatise, Bass Ackward Business, business owner Steve Beecham summarily admits, "I've never considered myself a brilliant businessman. The country was experiencing one of the great refinance booms of all time, and I jumped in with both feet. Unfortunately, the refinance well dried up before my feet got wet. I went 6 months without a deal, and when I did finally close one, it was for my brother's home. Instead of starting over, I set out to find a way to make the business work. This is when my fate started to turn." Beecham had already failed in 2 previous business ventures, a retail store and a recycling enterprise, prior to his attempt in the mortgage business. He had every reason to pack it up and head back to school or consider letting someone else hold the reins. He resisted long enough to see that his approach was wrong from the beginning. He was after business when he should have been after relationships. He goes on to describe an unexpected encounter in a parking lot with a selfless celebrity that taught him the visceral value of taking interest in others' interests. "Before I could get another word in, he started asking me questions. Where'd you grow up? What do you do for a living? What high school did you go to? What are your kids' names?" I left the encounter feeling 10 feet tall. In a subtle and unassuming way, he'd elevated himself in my mind. The encounter taught Beecham an invaluable lesson. From that day forward, he committed to asking thoughtful questions of every new person he met and every acquaintance he didn't know very well. "Specifically," he explains, "I decided to become a problem solver and a promoter, with no strings attached. This is when my business began to not only turn around, it began to take off." In a matter of months, Beecham's job turned into a lucrative career, and soon he became so successful he owned a mortgage company that has since its inception remained at the top of the industry. Perhaps more significant is that his business has been 100% referral-based for a decade. He estimates that each day, 1/4 of the calls his office receives have nothing to do with obtaining a mortgage, something he's very proud of. They are people calling with questions like, "Where should I get my car repaired? Where should I take my in-laws to dinner? And whom should I call for life insurance?" He explains that these people call him because he's become known as the go-to guy in a large local network of friends. "I didn't get that way by holding free mortgage seminars or erecting a large billboard featuring my confident, trustworthy face," quips Beecham. "I got that way by helping people without hustling them for business. It is why Thoreau wrote, 'Goodness is the only investment that never fails.'" The same spirit of relating is within reach of every one of us in every interaction. How simple it is to set out motivated only to get to know others and find a problem you can help solve or a pursuit you can help promote. This is the simple secret to what Beecham calls Bass Ackward Business. Yet the truth is, the typical ways most conduct themselves in business relationships is what's backward. "I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine." This isn't reciprocity, it's bartering, an entirely different trajectory that removes the magic. And it's unadulterated magic that makes interactions so memorable. It's what draws us in. There is trust and a genuine sense of belonging and meaning. Today, there is simply no excuse not to take an interest in others' interests. Even if you are not actively involved in clubs, groups, or local organizations where face-to-face interactions are possible, there is still an abundance of opportunities to learn about others' passions and concerns. What could happen if you spent 5 minutes every day reading through the Facebook page of three friends, the professional biographies of three clients, or the personal blogs of three employees you haven't taken the time to know well? For starters, you'd certainly learn something about them you didn't know before. It's also likely you would come to appreciate them more. Perhaps you have similar interests. This is fodder for future conversation, even for future collaboration. Perhaps one is going through a difficult time. This is an opportunity to engage them with encouragement and a greater level of empathy. Perhaps you have a mutual friend. Wouldn't this make your relationship much easier, as trust is already established in a common friend and time is already invested in common experiences? One can never underestimate the importance of affinity. "We tend to dislike what we don't know," blogged Amy Martin, founder of social media powerhouse Digital Royalty and one of Forbes magazine's 20 best-branded women on Twitter, after her first experience with NASCAR. "Many people don't understand, or better yet, get, the so-called monotonous day of left turns and mullets." She was admittedly in that camp before attending the 2011 Daytona 500. Shortly thereafter, she wrote a blog post singing NASCAR's praises for achieving a level of genuine connection and influence with its fan base that is rare in professional sports. "Here's what I learned," she writes. "Drivers do fan Q&As and autograph sessions the day of the race. The Daytona 500 happens to be the biggest day of the year for NASCAR. I don't think Brett Favre was chatting it up with thousands of fans the day of the Super Bowl. I received a magical hot pass and could go anywhere. It was uncomfortably exciting having unlimited access, and at times I worried about getting in the crew's way. I was a part of the action and wasn't the only one. Bottom line, fans have access." As for why Martin believes NASCAR's approach is a smart move for any sport, she cites the following reasons. Access leads to connection. Fans are able to sign the actual racetrack. Connection leads to relationships, at all ages. Relationships lead to affinity. You can't fake this affinity. Affinity leads to influence. There's a reason so many brands are attracted to NASCAR. Influence leads to conversion. These fans would likely buy anything this driver is selling. Martin ends her post with a nod to the potential reach of NASCAR's genuine connectivity with its fan base, 150,000 fans in the stands and 30 million television viewers, were they to embrace the opportunities the digital age affords them. "There is huge potential," she writes, "when you apply this same access via social media to a larger audience. What if the same behind-the-scenes access available to fans physically at the Daytona 500 was available to those billions of potential fans on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube who are not watching the race on TV?" Martin's post bridges the two key points of taking interest in others' interests today. 1. Human relations are always easier when they begin from a place of affinity. 2. The potential for relational connectivity is astronomical. The bottom line is that you must become genuinely interested in others before you can ever expect anyone to be interested in you. "All things being equal," said author John Maxwell in a recent interview, "people do business with people they like. All things not being equal, they still do. We like people who like us. So to be liked, you must exhibit admiration for the things others do and say." Many have argued that people no longer have much interest in others. The me focus dominates how we think, act, and communicate. Yet you have so many opportunities to stay connected, to learn more, to show your interest. Changing how you spend just a small portion of each day can dramatically change how others perceive your level of interest in them. Changing your customer engagement strategy can dramatically change how the marketplace perceives your company. Instead of spending each day refining your digital media, spend time relating to your friends, colleagues, and clients. Post brief, admiring notes. Interact with them and discover what problems you might help solve or what pursuits you might help promote. We are all driven by pain and pleasure, so such prospects exist in every person. When you are sincere in your endeavors to connect with others, chances are always higher that meaningful connection will occur. Progressive, mutually beneficial collaboration is then possible. And today, genuine connection and collaboration can quickly become infectious. Chapter 2. Smile. Getting people to agree about virtually anything is practically impossible. Take Neil Armstrong's 1969 romp across the moon. In the United Kingdom, only 75% of people believe it actually happened. Only 94% of Americans believe it happened. In countries such as Mexico, China, and Indonesia, fewer than a third of respondents believe Al-Qaeda had anything to do with the 9/11 attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C. In the United States, 16% of people believe it was planted explosives rather than burning passenger jets that brought down the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. About half of citizens in the European Union believe in God. There is one thing that does unite us, however. According to the American Academy of Cosmetic Dentistry, 99.7% of adults believe a smile is an important social asset. It's a difficult statistic to refute, even if you aren't in the business of perfecting smiles. We gravitate to grins and giggles. Consider the all-time most viewed videos on YouTube. The top two are all about smiles. In the most viewed, from the United Kingdom, Harry, a 3-year-old boy, and his 1-year-old brother Charlie are playing for the camera when Charlie grabs one of Harry's fingers and shoves it in his mouth. A moment later, he chomps down, and Harry yelps in displeasure, retrieving his finger. All the while, Charlie smiles. That smile eventually wins as Harry's smile returns and giggles ensue. The other video is from Sweden. In it, a baby boy smiles, giggles, and laughs in response to his parents' silly sounds. It is nearly 2 minutes of face cramp-inducing smiles. A combined 500 million views tells us all we need to know. Smiles send a message we like to receive. Smiling is innate, says Daniel McNeil, author of The Face, A Natural History. Some sort of smile, he writes, first appears 2 to 12 hours after birth. No one knows whether these smiles have any content. McNeil suspects they do not, but studies show they are crucial to bonding. What no one can debate, however, is the power of a smile, no matter its origin. McNeil notes that while courtroom judges are equally likely to find smilers and non-smilers guilty, they give smilers lighter penalties, a phenomenon called the smile leniency effect. Smiles also have a proliferation effect. Nicholas Christakis, a physician and sociologist at Harvard, and James Fowler, a political scientist at the University of California, San Diego, with special expertise in social networks, published a paper in the British Medical Journal in 2008, entitled Dynamic Spread of Happiness in a Large Social Network. They knew emotions could spread over short periods of time from person to person, in a process known as emotional contagion. But what they wanted to know was just how widely and sustainably happiness spread in social networks. They followed 4,739 people from 1983 to 2003. These individuals were embedded in a larger network of 12,067 people, each having an average of 11 connections to others, including friends, family, co-workers, and neighbors. And their happiness was assessed every few years using a standard measure. The researchers' findings confirmed the impact of a happy person, which smiling conveys directly. Social networks, they concluded, have clusters of happy and unhappy people within them that reach out to 3 degrees of separation. A person's happiness is related to the happiness of their friends' friends, and their friends' friends' friends. That is, to people well beyond